Peter Bundock. This recording is part of the oral history project carried out by the Suffolk Horse Society in 2013, with advice from Cambridge Community Heritage and a generous grant from the Heritage Lotteries Fund. In the recording, you will hear the voice of Mr. Peter Bundock describing his memories of the Suffolk Punch Heavy Horse. Peter is a horseman and farrier who lives in West Thurrock, Essex. The recording was made by Juliet Pennell, who is a member of the Suffolk Horse Society. The date of the recording was the 22nd of August 2013 and was carried out at Banham Zoo. The duration of the recording is about 25 minutes.
This is Juliet Pennell interviewing Peter Bundock on Thursday the 22nd of August 2013 for Working Horses, Working Lives, sharing our stories of the Suffolk Punch.
Hello, it's Peter Bundock. I'm a farrier and horseman, and I just had my 70th birthday a few weeks ago.
And you're still shoeing horses?
Yes, and I went out yesterday actually and done three-year-olds. All they had their first shoes on yesterday, and they all went okay. It was very good. There was quite no problem with them.
Oh. Can you tell us how you became a farrier? What led you into it?
Well, I'd always worked with horses, and right from a youngster, like, you know, I've been around horses and whatever. But when I left school, there was a local shoe factory, and it was the sort of dumb thing. But, like, you know, most of the lads and my age when I left school we finished up in the shoe factory, and I started there on a Monday morning, and I looked out the window and I thought, my God, what have I done to deserve this? The noise, the clattering of machinery. And by Wednesday lunchtime, I'd had enough, so I had to be noticing and walked out. I had two granddads, but one had died just previous to that. But the other granddad said, well, what are you going to do? I said, well, I don't know. He said, well, go down and see the old Billy. So I'll take you down to see him, the old blacksmith. He said he could do with a hand. He said, I'm sure he'd appreciate some help. And I worked for him for 12 years until he died. And one of my uncles, he said to me, what are you missing about shoeing blooming horses for? He said, no future in that. He said, when you're 80, I'll get you in the docks, he said. And I said, well, I don't really want to go in the docks. He said, yeah, you're better off than the docks. There's no future shoeing horses. And it's amazing, all the docks are gone and finished, and I'm still shoeing horses.
Amazing. And the chap you were apprenticed to, I mean, he was getting on a bit by then.
Yes, he was born January 3rd, 1890.
Amazing and, span of history,
yeah,
really.
Yeah. And I started with him in 1958, and I worked with him till 1970.
Amazing. And what sort of things did you make? I mean, it wasn't only shoeing horses.
Oh, no,
there.
No, because we were close to the docks and the railway. You've got to remember, there was no forklifts in them days, and we used to make lots of sack barrow blades to go on the front of a sack barrow, because where they rubbed on the concrete, they'd wear out like horseshoes. And all the porters and the railway workers and that, they all had their favourite sack barrow, and if they were going off for a few days or on holiday, they'd wheel it across to the shop for us to leave it in there while they put a new blade on it while I was away. And docker's hooks, all the hooks were, everything came in bags or bales and barrels, and the dockers had a hook for every job, the bagging hooks and rubber bale hooks and all different, slightly different, and we used to make lots and lots of them, bright steel, and they'd come in, and there'd be a rubber boat coming in the next morning, and they've heard about, and you make a hook up for me, and
So quite a variety, but you saw Suffolks as well at this stage. You were shoeing horses too?
Yes, we were shoeing lots of horses. And the old governor, he had a few meadows himself, and he was a horse dealer as well. And he'd always buying and selling horses, and he'd get on the train and go to the Elephant and Castle horse repository. And I can remember the lad, I was amazed, because they had big tin gates on it, and when you was in there, sometimes the police had come round and the MPs and slammed the gate shut, looking for all the conscripts on the way from the army. They still had conscription there, and there was a lot of them, they'd come in there and they'd go right through, look at everyone, check everyone, of sort of army age, to make sure they wasn't on the run from the army. I can remember that as a lad. We had a Suffolk mare come in from a horse dealer called Ted Poulter. She was a Roe Edge mare, and I can't remember her name, but I know it was a Roe Edge, and because the old boss wanted one to do some haymaking. So Ted said to him, he said, she'll do your job, William, he said. She's only a young mare, he said, but you wouldn't have her, he said, but it's just that we can't get shoes on. He said, they've tried everywhere, he said, and she's been in several blacksmith shops, and they can't get any shoes on her, she just won't have it, she'll fall over, you won't. And the old boss, oh, okay, he said, well, she'll do my job, barefoot, cut my bit of grass. We had a bit of a quiet time, and I think it started raining, and so he got it in his head now, it was like a challenge. So I think we'll have a set of shoes on that mare. And he said, Ted said she likes to fall, she'd fall over on her if you try and pick her feet up. He said, well, she likes to fall over. He said, we'll have her on the floor. And we put a set of hobbles on her. Actually, I gave the hobbles to Roger Clark a few years ago. I had no more use for them. But they were four collars, like a big strong collar with a chain that ran through them. As they moved, the chain had tighten up a notch, and eventually their 4 feet pull in together and they go over, they can't stop. And we covered her over with an old tarpaulin sheet and left her there for about 2 hours. Went up to the cafe and had a breakfast and a cup of tea, come back, uncovered her, and undone hobbles. Up she got, and within an hour, just over an hour, she had 4 shoes on. She didn't want to go on the floor again. That's why, we've got to remember there was no sedation then. There was no vets to come around and sedate them. And you had to cope the best way you can. And, we had all sorts of little things like that. I know there was one old lady who used to, I believe she was a solicitor's clerk or something, but she had this pony and she used to follow the hump with a pony and trap. But you could never tie this pony up. So she wouldn't hear of it, and he used to say, "There's no such thing as can't," and she wouldn't hear it. She just wouldn't have it. She had to hold this pony, couldn't tie up. So one day she said, "Could we look after the pony? She was going on holiday for a week," and he had a look of delight on his face. I knew what was coming, and "That's no problem at all," he said. So anyway, the pony got left there. I don't think she was on the train. He said, "Go and get that pony." So we're in the shop, great big rings on the wall, and he went and got a piece of rope with an eye in it, put it right round its belly, just in front of its hind legs, up between the front legs, threw the ring in the head collar, and tied it to the wall. Well, the pony jumped back, and because the first thing it tightened up was right round its belly. And it sort of had a look of shock on its face almost, and it jumped forward again and stood there. And he laughed, and he said, "There's no such thing as can't." And he couldn't wait for her to come back off holiday. She got off the train, and she'd only got to walk across the road, from the station to the shop. And there was the pony tied up in the farrier shop. Yeah, there's all sorts of little things like that they used to do, delight him.
Experience paid off. And can you tell me, did you see any horses on the docks themselves?
Not working, but in the 50s, as a lad before I started for him, actually, because I lived in near the docks. We, as lads, we used to go down there and climb over the fence in the docks, and any of them with good head collars on, we used to take the head collars off them. Now, it was all going to France, going to Europe for slaughter, unfortunately, but it was only that there were councils packing up, and you'd get perhaps 8 or 9 shire horses, and they all stood in crates, and they were lifted up singly in a crate and put on the decks of ships. And I can remember, there was a Daily Mirror, I believe, where they had a great big thing about, stop the live horse export. And it wasn't, they were fed and watered, but not a lot. They wanted them empty. They didn't want them full of food to go out for slaughter. And they got water, but they never got a lot of food. It was terrible. There were Suffolks and Shires and, you know, light horses. It was, you know, mostly working horses, not riding horses, mostly working horses. And it was a crying shame, really.
And which docks were these?
Tilbury.
Tilbury.
Yeah, because when you think it was only a short journey across to... from, like, you know, from Tilbury across, like, the Channel to Europe, Belgium and Holland and France, and it was a shame. But I think perhaps when you think, like, we're in this country, we now there's nothing sort of killed or slaughtered. If you've got a mare that's, like, wrong or something, like, you know, not quite right in the head, which you get quite, they say, oh, we'll turn it out and have a foal out of it. I said, but, like, in Europe, they eat them. And anything bad, anything with a problem, like, you know, but I think in this country we've carried on breeding it, and that's why we've got a few problem horses now, like, you know, that's...
We've bred in the problem. Yeah, we've continued the problem.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
Can you tell us about your early experiences with horses? You were brought up with horses and from a very early age. Can you tell us a bit about those experiences?
Yeah, unfortunately, mother died when I was 6 or 7, and I went to live with one nan and granddad, because I had no chance, really, because both granddads were horsemen. One's horseman on the brewery, and the other one was horseman on the farm. And I went to live on the farm with nan and granddad in Farm Cottage, and... it was hard, I suppose, really. Like, you know, of an evening time, we used to have to make purse nets for the ferrets. So I can remember saying they used to make me make at least one, because we lived on, like, rabbit and off the farm, like, really. At least one purse net every evening. And Bob was sitting listening to the radio. And then we had to have it. Then the Archers was on. And then after that, Dick Barton. And then it was bedtime. But... one day, Grandad hadn't been well, he wasn't well, and the old boss said to me, can you take Grandad's horses and hoe up between them cabbage plants? I ran a Kent hoe up between all the cabbage plants, he said. They never had all the weed killer sprays and that we've got today. And I said, yeah, well, I put the horse in, just single horse, and I sweated, and all I was in one row, and then he'd walk across into the next row, and I got home at lunchtime and I said to Nan, Nan said, what's the matter? I said, well, I said, I've been hoeing. I said, and when the old boss sees it, I said, he'll sack me, I reckon. I said, I'll decode more cabbage plants out than weeds. So she said, what's the trouble? I said, well, I said, old Bowler, I said, he goes up there and I said, 1 minute he's in one row and then he walks across into the next row and all that. So I said to Grandad, I said, he won't walk straight. He said, well, you've got him, boy, you stick to him. You sort him out, he said. You sort him out yourself. Anyway, on my way back to Nan come out, I was just getting on my bicycle to go back out of the farm. She said, look, she said, he's not going to be about here forever to help you. You've got to start thinking for yourself. Now, when he's ploughing, who's he having the furrow? I said, Bonnie. He said, Bowler for the cart work, Bonnie for the row work. I went back, I took the harness off of Bowler, put it on Bonnie, and we went out and she didn't put a foot wrong. She was a pigeon-toed mare, walked right up the rows and never put a foot wrong, and we made a wonderful job. And I think within a week, 10 days, he was dead. And you know, but I've always thought of that, like, you know, you know, there comes a time in life, you know, that you have got to start thinking for yourself. You've got your parents or your grandparents telling you what to do, but eventually you have got to think for yourself. And he knew that, and you know, at the time I thought, miserable old beggar, but, you know, when you sort of reflect on it, it's life.
And you say Bonnie, she was pigeon-toed, and that was actually perhaps quite a good thing, was it?
Well, yeah, because if you can imagine pigeon-toed, they almost walk one foot in front of the other. You get something like a little bit wide, they tread on more plants, like a row, 18-inch, like, you know, a row perhaps between cabbages or, you know, at potato balks going in between the potatoes. We used to run a break up between the potatoes to kill the weeds, and or like, you know, and then you'd bulk them up again. Like you wanted something that could walk in a row, and as they walked, pigeon toed, they'd walk one foot in front of the other. But it was bred into them. I mean, the old boy, they'd love a pigeon toed horse. But unfortunately, in the show ring today, some of these younger judges, they see something pigeon-toed and they put it down. You can get some nice mares or gelding, but you know, they're pigeon-toed. But unfortunately, it's been bred into them for years. But that was the reason why they wanted them pigeon to have a row work, and they'd walk up a furrow like a cat, or you know, and. But I say, like, and unfortunately, like, people now have them to show them in the show ring, which is lovely. But they get, you know, condemned for it.
Yes. And could you tell us about when you were shoeing? I mean, did you hot shoe or cold shoe the horses? How did it work?
When we was in the shop, we anything that came to the shop was hot shod. We made all our own shoes. We didn't buy any shoes at all. They were all handmade. Then sometimes in the afternoon, I'd make shoes up for the next day, and I'd go out on an old trade bike shoe cold. A few ponies or hunters or different, you know, perhaps someone got a loose shoe, you'd just go out and tighten it up cold, or, you know. But most of them that came in the shop were all shod hot.
And when you were making the shoes, how long would it take you to make a shoe, a pair of shoes, or a...
Well, we used to work them in sets, work them in fours, and you'd have four pieces of iron, like, you know, you'd bank the fire up, you'd have four pieces of iron laid on top of the fire, and you'd drop one down, because they were all bellows, if you can imagine, no electric, it was big pear-shaped bellows, and you had to pump the bellows as you were working, and you'd get your first piece in the fire. When you took that to work on it, you'd drop the next piece in the fire, and while you was working on the first shoe, the second one would be drawing it like it's getting its heat, and... you'd get your toe bend in the first shoe, and then you'd put the one branch in and the outside branch back in the fire and pump it again. But like that time, your second bar was hot, and you'd get your toe bend in that and then put that in the fire, and in the branch, like half the shoe in. And the first one was still hot. And you had a few pumps and a few death pumps of the bellows, and that was ready to work. And, you know, you'd work. So you couldn't really waste coal or waste fuel, like, not man. And because you had no, like, you know, now you've got the electric, and, but it was like you didn't want to waste any sort of pumps of the bellows, like, to, you know, to...
And are you still making shoes today?
Yes, I enjoy making shoes. I made two pair up yesterday, two pair of fronts. I used one set that lady on a very fine, like, thoroughbred type horse. She wanted a pair of aluminium fronts on it. It was its first time it had shoes on, and she's going to do dressage with it or something. So she wanted aluminium shoes on it. So I bought some out, a pair of aluminium shoes, and put on it. But the other two, I made the shoes for, yeah.
And how long does it take you to make a pair of shoes?
I wouldn't think more than to make them and put them on the horse was 3/4 an hour. A pair of shoes and they were on the horse and all nailed and finished off. I wouldn't think it was, like, you know, more than 3/4 an hour each horse.
Amazing. Yeah. And making a shoe for a horse rather than adapting a bought shoe, is that easier for you? Because, I mean...
Sometimes, yeah, when you have the first shoes on, their feet are a little bit broken or worn. The horse, when it walks, it lands outside of the foot first and slides. And you'll find most horses that are unshod, the outside is worn off and the inside gets long, and their feet lay over a bit twisted, and they get a bit of a funny shape. So I find it's easier to make a shoe, and, like, you know, then it takes you almost as long to shape a machine-made shoe up. And, yeah, so and I quite enjoy shoe making anyway.
And as well as shoeing, you've also broken horses as well for the trade.
Yeah, when the old boss died in 1970, I drove a lorry a little bit, and I shod weekends. There wasn't so many horses about there quite then, like, you know. And there's a few local riding schools. I used to go there shoeing weekends. And then I went on a local farm, old Jim Young. He had a few working horses at the time, and I used to go down and help him. And I started shoeing his heavy horses. And then I finished up on Whitbridge Brewery. And I went up there as farrier. When I went up there into London, we had 42 horses in the stables. And two old farriers, one old Purse and Johnny Walker. But Purse didn't want to retire, he carried on. So the boss there said, well, we'll keep you on, but like, if anything happens to the other, any of the others, like, if you don't mind going in the farrier shop, I said, no, that's okay. So I went up, I stayed there as horseman, which was actually, it was more money than the farrier, being a horseman. And I never did go in the farrier shop as a farrier, because like, the horse had gradually got cut down, and old Purse retired, but Johnny Walker said he could manage, he could carry on. He was a funny Irish one, he could be a little bit of a character. So I finished up after the Lord Mayor show in November. I used to go down to Paddock Wood, which where Whitbridge had a great big hop farm, and any youngsters down there, any young horses that the boss had bought, I used to sort of get them ready to get, like, you know, get them broken to chains and whatever, and then go out to London with them after in March and the following year, and then spend 5 or 6 months taking them out street training, and that went on for a number of years. Well, you know,
and it was very important, good. Presumably, that they were very quiet in London.
Well, it was, and the thing is, you couldn't buy broken horses. Years ago, used to, like, on the farm, when farms was in full swing, farmers, a 2-3 year old, they'd have horses broken and working, and they'd work them for a couple of years on the farm. When they'd been matured, you get a nice big gelding, 5-year-old matured, it was worth quite a bit of money. And the railways and the breweries, like, you know, they used to almost fight over them. Like, you know, that was the idea of what they wanted. They'd had a couple of years light work on the farm, because farm work isn't that heavy, really. Like, you know, perhaps a little bit of light carting or haymaking, and, you know, then a little bit of ploughing as they got older, but they was all ready to go to work. But unfortunately, look, there's quite a few farmers about, as the old farmers sort of died off or retired, their sons didn't mind carrying on and having an old mare about the place and breeding a foal. But when that was come a weaning age or a year, they wanted, you know, wanted it gone. They didn't want to mess about breaking it in and keeping its 5-year-old. They just wanted it gone. So the only way we could get horses, grey horses that we had on Whitbreds, when you see a grey youngster, was to buy it as a yearling or a 2-year-old, and then we'd turn them out on the hot farm in Kent and run them on from there. And they'd run out in the grass all the summer, then in October, November time, I'd go down to the Paddock Wood, and anything that was sort of mature, 3-4 year old, and start getting it broken, ready to go to London.
Peter, thank you very much for telling us about your stories with horses. I mean, before we finish, are there any other stories you could tell us?
Well, I could tell you. I lived with Nan and Grandad on the farm. Grandad, he used to like to buy and sell a few ponies. He'd like a pony. And because we were quite a way out of town, Nan, Saturday morning, I'd take her shopping. And she'd... Grandad bought this pony one day, and it was a Hackney Welsh Cob Cross, and it was a bit sharp, and I loved it. Yeah, it's like a youngster now with a motorcycle, I suppose, like a little bit of speed. I suppose I was about 13, and we've got gone to town, and it almost sparks coming out of his feet. He's really sharp. So took Nan shopping, stood outside in the town. I'd stand by the cart, the horse head, and she'd go in the greengrocer and get a few bits that she needed, a bit of fruit and whatever. She never bought any veg because we worked on the farm. And then she'd go and get some bread in the baker's and bits and pieces and the groceries. She'd keep fetching them out in boxes, or the grocer would fetch them out, but we'd put them on the cart. And home we went. Man never said a word. Next morning, Sunday morning, Granddad's put the pony in harness. And I thought, that's unusual. He usually goes to the pub on his bike. But I've got to clean the ferrets out and done a few jobs. I wasn't going to the pub, like 13. Off he went. When he came home, he's got this mouldy-headed old pony, grey-headed, must have been about 25-year-old. I never said anything. He put it in the stable. All the week, he sat in this little bit of a paddock. Saturday morning, I've only got him. Touched him with a whip. He trotted 10 paces and straight back to a walk. Well, anyway, Saturday afternoon, Granddad said, "How'd the old pony go?" I said, "What'd you sell old Tina for?" I said, "Pony." I said, "Can't get a trot out of it." He said, "Well," he said, "I like the other pony as well," he said, "but it's your grandma's fault." He said, "She says she'd sooner die of boredom than fear."
Peter, thank you very much. And it's a lovely story. Thank you.
You're welcome.